How old is the Ness of Brodgar?
Who put it there?
And what happened to the people who built it?
I'm on Orkney to get answers to your questions about this incredible Neolithic site. It's a question and answers Ness of Brodgar special edition on the Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And Martin, you are actually there. You've made it all the way to the Ness of Brodgar.
Oh, I have. And I've been here for a day or so now. I am loving it, I have to say. Where I am exactly at the moment, because you might think, well, it doesn't really sound like you're on the Ness of Brodgar. That is because I've had to run inside to shelter from the ever-changing weather. This is the thing that you noticed, first of all, when you get to this incredible place. It is that the weather changes with the click of a finger. So when I arrived today to set up for our podcast recording, the rain was coming down, drizzling, it was windy. Now, just a little while later, it's cleared up a little bit, the rain has stopped, I can see some of the hills in the distance. This is a beautiful, beautiful landscape. I notice as well a distinct lack of trees, which I think is, you don't really, until somebody says, oh, there's no trees, you go, oh yeah, that's what's sort of missing from what you're used to. The site is, oh, I would say about 100 metres from where I am at the moment. I can see it through the window of, I'm actually in the kitchen. So every now and again, you're going to hear an archaeologist come in and make themselves a cup of tea or have a biscuit or something like that. This is the little retreat. But I'm right next to, at the moment, Nick Card, who is the director of the Ness of Brodgar. Really good to see you, Nick, and thank you so much for welcoming, well, all of Time Team really here. It's been a bit of an invasion, I imagine.
Total invasion. But as usual, Time Team have been almost invisible on site. Well, not quite invisible, but no problem at all. Very pleased to welcome you all here.
Well, it's brilliant that you're here and able to chat with us for a little bit on the podcast, because we've been getting loads and loads of questions from our Time Team members. People are desperate to know more about this site. And I thought this was a great opportunity where we could sit and just have a little bit of a chat and answer some of the questions that have been coming in. And Helen, you've got a few of them there. I've got a few of them here. And I think between us, we can maybe put some questions to Nick as the sort of the font of all knowledge here about the site. I mean, how long have you been working here?
Well, I've been working in Orkney on and off, well, for about the last 40 odd years, but at the Ness about half that time, over 20 years now. So from the very inception of the project back in 2003, really.
So here's the first question. It's from Anne Radmore, and she says, could you give me an overview of the history timeline of the Ness and its development? When might it have begun? What archaeology supports that? And when did it end?
Oh, simple question to begin with.
Yeah, just all the big ones there.
Before I answer all these specific questions, I'd just like to mention that the Ness of Brodgar's own website, nessofbrodgar.co.uk, and you'll find probably the answers to all these questions, but in much more detail than we have today. So excellent resource. Have a look. I'm sure you'll all love it. But the Ness, well, the earliest evidence we have from the Ness is, in fact, Mesolithic activity. Just a few microliths, classic Mesolithic hunter-gatherer type flint tools. But the Neolithic really starts, well, the earliest dates we have are probably about 3,500. And the Ness continues all the way through to really the beginning of the Bronze Age, the Chalcolithic, around about 2,300, 400 in Orkney. The Ness, we have every aspect of the Neolithic all the way through its entire history.
So what is the archaeological evidence for that? Is it pottery? Is it stratigraphy? Is it carbon dating? What kind of thing is backing up those years?
All those types of evidence. We have about 160 radiocarbon dates from the site, some of which do go back to the Mesolithic. We have other ranges, other types of dating evidence from archaeomagnetic dating and also OSL dating, but also the kind of cultural assemblage, which ranges from early Neolithic round-based pots right the way through the whole gamut of grooveware styles. So we have everything to support that, but also at the Ness we have all these changes in architecture from the early Neolithic structures right the way through to Structure 10, which reflect the kind of domestic structures we see at, say, Scarab Brae, but here at the Ness on a massive grand scale.
And I suppose another obvious question is, as Anne wants to know, when did it end? Another question is, why did it end? Do you know where the people have gone, for example?
Well, I think they still remain here, although there's possibly other influxes at the beginning of the Bronze Age. Beaker evidence, we have a bit of beaker pottery at the Ness, only one or two, possibly two sherds. But I think society is just changing. Whatever the Ness had represented for the 1,000-plus years over the Neolithic period, the introduction of metalwork, we see so many other changes in society happening, differences in economy, burial practice, types of houses, structures. Every aspect is changing. Doesn't happen overnight, happens probably over several generations. But the Ness is a kind of eclipsed, and so it's almost put to bed at the end of the Neolithic, where we see the whole site being created into this massive mound, almost a monument in its own right. But yes, times are changing.
I'm going to move on to a question now from Georgina. This is Georgina Churchlow, who is talking about, well, something that I can basically see if I just move my head around just a little bit and look out of the window from where we are at the moment. I can see Maze Howe, and Georgina wants to talk about that. She says, near the Ness is Maze Howe, which is a cairn. However, it doesn't seem much different from a barrow or tumulus. Is there a difference? Well, maybe we should start, Nick, by explaining what Maze Howe is and its relationship to the Ness.
Well, the Maze Howe is a chambered tomb, almost undoubtedly Neolithic in date, although there's sadly no dating evidence for it yet. Whether, in fact, anyone will ever get dating for its construction is a matter for Historic Environment Scotland. It'd be lovely to conduct further excavations in the middle of the mound in the central chamber, but I can't see that happening, really. It differs from being a barrow or a tumulus. Barrows and tumulus are typically Bronze Age in date, but here you have this magnificent mound, and inside you enter through this long passageway into the central chamber with side chambers going off it. But it's probably the finest piece of the finest Neolithic chamber tomb anywhere, in my estimation. It's one of these wonders. Everybody should have it on their bucket list. But when the Vikings broke into it in the 11th to 12th century, they probably cleared out any evidence that may have gave a better indication about what it was used for. But the general consensus is that it was a place for the interment of bodies, maybe not from the whole of the population, maybe from a select few.
And it is absolutely huge as well. It really does stand out in the landscape. I'm just looking across the lock here, across the water from the Ness of Brodgar over to it. And if I just about, I can just about see, because it's just slightly further round, but it's really, really prominent in the landscape, isn't it? I mean, how big is it?
It's, I think, overall about 70 metres in diameter, and today survives to a height of 6 or 7 metres. But when they entered it in the mid-19th century, they broke in through the roof. So the original construction, that's probably completely corbelled central chambers, kind of been truncated. Some of the early illustrations we have prior to that would seem to show a much more kind of conical mound, so it would have been even more prominent in the landscape. But it's the construction of it, the incorporation of these massive slabs of stone, some of them weighing several tons. And for instance, in the entrance passage, which consists of basically four massive slabs, which may have came from a stone circle, forming the sides, roof and the floor of the passageway. It's just one of the wonders of the ancient world.
Yes, it's very hard to imagine, isn't it, that how those stones were manhandled, how they were moved into place. and the size is absolutely monstrous. It's twice the size of Mound 1 or Mound 2 at Sutton Hoo, for example, if like me, you go around measuring things by the size of mounds at Sutton Hoo. But to answer Georgina's question about what the difference is between a barrow or a tumulus or a cairn, as I understand it, a cairn is made of stones. A mound can be made instead of earth. A barrow or a tumulus are just more words for the same thing. So a tumulus is like a kind of posh Latin term. A barrow is a more English term, and a mound is much more neutral. But a chambered tomb, of course, has this architecture of the corbelling and the chambers, and it's more like a building that's then been covered with a mound.
Yeah, in essence, that's right. In some ways, it's a matter of semantics, almost, as in barrow, tumulus, mound. And in Orkney, they're called howes, an old Norse word which basically means mound. But in general, barrow, tumulus, mound don't have central chambers. They may have a central burial, but sometimes you have satellite burials inserted into the mound or around the outside of the mound. But usually it's in Orkney anyway, you have a kind of stone kist, a stone coffin being inserted.
Every time I see it, it just does take your breath away. It is so big on the landscape, and you would have been able to see it from here as well the whole time, which is, you know, the connection between the two places is obvious. Brilliant question. Thank you very much, Georgina. Keep them coming, please.
This is the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek at home and Martin Williams at the Ness of Brodgar in Orkney, alongside Nick Card, the director of the Ness of Brodgar. And Nick, what would you say the most common question you get asked about the Ness of Brodgar is?
It always amazes me the variety of questions that get asked. But I think most people are intrigued by where the Ness fits in to the timeline of all these other amazing Neolithic sites we have. The Ring of Brodgar, the stones of Stoness, Mace Howe, all the elements of the heart of Neolithic World Heritage Site. But these monuments are only a tiny part of the kind of overall Neolithic landscape we have. But the easy thing is, with that particular question, is that the Ness is contemporary with all of these other Neolithic sites, because the Ness spans a whole of the Neolithic. So although all these sites, they date to the Neolithic, they weren't all built at the same time, but there was overlap between them.
Right. Do we know which one came first? Because we do have these, well, certainly three. I mean, there's the Ring of Brodgar I can see from where I am. So that's probably, 500 metres away. There's what we're excavating at the moment on the Ness, 100 metres away. And then the other way, if I look behind me, the stones of Stenness, and then there's Mace Howe over the water. So we've got all of these in a very, very close area. But which one came first?
Easy question again. The Ness of Brodgar. It's been one of the real eye-openers for us, is to realise that there was a major settlement or site here predating all these other amazing monuments. I think sometimes that the monumentality we see in the Neolithic, it seems to start in the later Neolithic, and people consider that the Ring of Brodgar, the stones of Stoness, Mace Howe, are those key elements to that. But what we've learned with the Ness is, for instance, the massive wall, the so-called Great Wall of Brodgar, is one of the earliest elements of the site, and it's contemporary with some of the early Neolithic buildings that we have at the Ness, like Structure 5. So the Ness seems to predate them all. So everything else seems to rotate around the Ness. The Ness was the hub right from the very beginning of the Neolithic.
Nick, the Time Team documentary on YouTube, it takes us through 20 years of digging at the site. What do you think the main things are that we've learnt in those 20 years that we didn't know before?
The questions get easier and easier.
I know, that's
difficult, more difficult.
Yeah.
There's so many aspects of of what we've uncovered over the last 20 years have really transformed our understanding of the Neolithic, not just in Orkney, but further afield. The construction of some of these buildings really does just take your breath away. We knew what the Neolithic people were capable of, but the Ness seems to just move several levels above anything else that we've seen. But it's also when you think about the logistics, it's time to maybe reconsider the estimates for the Neolithic population in Orkney, because the amount of material that had to be quarried, transported here, and then put up into these amazing structures, you're looking at tens of thousands of tons. So the organisation, which we always knew Neolithic society was a complex, evolving society throughout the Neolithic era, but the Neolithic art, which we have over 1,200 examples from the Ness, and a lot of that still in situ. So it's allowing us to ask much more detailed questions of what this might mean, how the art was used, how the art evolved. And again, this isn't just of concern to the Ness. There's many other sites where we find Neolithic art. So it's adding to the way that we interpret the art and what it can teach us.
I've got a question here from Kat, and Kat wants to know about the surveys that have been done. But before I ask it, I just wanted to sort of take you back to that moment. And you do see it at the end of the YouTube documentary that you can go and watch now about the 20 years of digging at the Ness of Brodgar. And that is the work that John Gater had done. You must have seen the image by now if you haven't already. It's that geophysics of the circular anomaly, as John Gater calls it. Can you just take me back to seeing that image for the first time and how it made you feel and the emotions that you had when you saw that incredible, perfectly circular set of blobs with that central blob as well and the tantalizing prospects of what that could mean?
Well, I think the reaction that you see in the film That wasn't any acting. That was just a pure look of shock from all of us, shock and amazement. And I think part of that shock was thinking, well, we said we'd finished in 2024, but I think all three of us, the three directors, myself, Mark and Anne, all kind of looked at each other and just knew we'd be back here for another season, because it was just so, so different from anything else we'd excavated than this. So I think that here we are back again over halfway through this present short season. And in some ways, it's already feeling sad. It's kind of bringing back all the memories of that final season in 2024 to think that, yeah, another week's time, we will finish excavating here, because this has to be it. We can't, we could continue excavating here for the next several hundred years, but this chapter of the Ness, we have to kind of draw a line under and just continue with the post-excavation work and get it published, do more academic papers and make sense of all these hundreds of thousands of strands of evidence that the Ness has produced.
Yeah, because I suppose that's the thing to think about as well, isn't it? That it doesn't mean that the discoveries will stop just because the digging has stopped. There's still so much that you can go through and more information that you can pull out of the data that you have recovered as archaeologists. I'll get on to Kat's question then, which is, have any underwater surveys been done at the Ness of Brodgar? And this is interesting because we've got water on both sides. We're on this spit of land with water on either side. And what I learned the other day from the very helpful information boards that are up on site at the moment is that the water level here would have been a lot lower, wouldn't it? Which means that maybe buildings would have been out on what is now water. So has there been any work done to establish the nature of those buildings? And how do you know they're there in the first place?
Well, there's the wonderful work that was undertaken by the sadly late lamented Caroline Wickham-Jones and her project Rising Tides, which was looking at changing sea levels, not only in the locks, but also around Orkney, the way that the landscape has been changed by particularly rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age and how much land has been inundated. But although both of these bodies of water, when the Ness was first built, they were both freshwater, whereas one today is saline, the Loch Ester Ness, and the other one, the Loch Aharry, on our right-hand side, is freshwater. But the sea probably broke through sometime during the early life of the Ness, maybe in a series of big storm events. But initially, because sea levels were still rising, water would have drained out from these two locks, not emptying them, but there would have been a lot kind of more land, boggy, marshy areas around the periphery of these two locks. And we know that from some of the work that Caroline did that there is material in the locks, but also some of the drone photography we've undertaken around the shores. We can see the old kind of coastline or shorelines along. So the Ness Peninsula, which today is about roughly 100 metres wide, would have been almost half as wide again. And one of my favourite dog walks, in fact, is along the shores of both bodies of water. And yes, I've picked up a few things, and there are a few stone alignments which you think probably represent other structures.
I'm just looking at the landscape on Google Earth. The lochs are almost completely enclosed, but not quite. I'm wondering what the quality of the water's like. Is it very clear? Would you get an awful lot out of an underwater survey because you can see for miles? Or is it more like a situation maybe in the North Sea where you wouldn't be able to see anything at all?
Well, so some of the bathymetric surveys that Caroline Wickham-Jones and her team's undertaken did show material, particularly in the Loch Ness. In the Loch Harry, there's more silt because it's basically more enclosed. It's not kind of tidal as is the Loch Ness. So there is potential to apply some of the new techniques. There's some of the new LIDAR that's being made available can actually apparently remove the water to give you that three-dimensional topographic survey. So we're hoping to apply some of that. But just with drones, it's amazing what you can see. But also some of the local fishermen report to us seeing large stones or other features that they've encountered when they wade out to catch some of the best trout anywhere in the world.
I bet.
Yeah, I mean, the fish and chips are fantastic here as well.
Yes, the Scottish lochs are just so mesmerising, aren't they? With their absolutely jewel clear waters and cold but not absolutely freezing. They're one of the best places to swim, I think, in the whole world.
It's beautiful. It might be a bit cold, but then again, some of the wildlife you get around here is just, yeah, unparalleled, I think. Not that I'm biased or anything.
And I have heard word, Helen, by the way, that our very own Jackie McKinley has been out swimming whilst she's been in the Northern Isles. So, I mean, you wouldn't get me doing that. So she's a far hardier person than I'll ever be.
Gosh, because I've been looking at the weather forecast every day, checking what kind of time you're having, and it has not been over about 17 degrees, has it?
No, it's been pretty chilly. I think, what is it about now? It's about 14 now at the moment. And this is meant to be a heat wave, is it?
This is subtropical for Orkney. This is just perfect weather.
She's very hardy, Jackie is.
She's very, very hardy, absolutely. Let's get another question, shall we? And this one comes in from Jacob, and this is talking actually about what you've slightly already alluded to, Nick, which is the fact that this marks the end, almost the second end, doesn't it, of excavations, because you finished in 2024, had to come back for one more season because of those remarkable geophysics results, but it does have to stop now. It does have to come to an end. So Jacob asks, what considerations are made for backfilling each site to maximise preservation? Now, I suppose the first thing to say is what you did between seasons over the 20 years of excavations that you were doing that ended in 2024, because you didn't backfill with soil. There was another process that went on to make sure that the archaeology was preserved so that you could return to it again the following year.
Well, at the end of each season, up until the end of 2024, we'd cover the site with various layers of plastic and geotextile membrane. And then to hold all of that acres of polythene in place, we laid tyres, as many farmers do over silage pits, just to hopefully keep it in place, because it does occasionally get quite windy up here, well, about every second day. But that was only a kind of temporary measure for while we were digging there. At the end of 2024, the very difficult decision was made to backfill the site, because returning it to the conditions that had protected it for the last 5,000 years was seen as the best way to maximise its preservation. There was no way that we could conserve the whole site to have it on permanent display. The cost of that, amongst other things, would have just been prohibitive, including the ongoing maintenance that would have required. Other people said, well, why don't you preserve it under a large dome? But again, the cost of that would be astronomical. But also, where would you actually dig foundations? Because the whole of the Ness Peninsula is archaeology. So you'd be digging more archaeology, exposing more archaeology to dig foundations. So it would have just been an ongoing process. So the best idea, the top of our priorities, is to preserve the archaeology for future generations. So the earth that we dug out was all carefully placed back in. We decided in consultation with various bodies that we wouldn't lay down a kind of membrane over the archaeology we dug. We'd just place the backfill directly on top of the archaeology. Some people have said, well, if anybody comes back, how will they know what is archaeology in situ and what is our backfill? Well, I think any archaeologist who can't differentiate between backfill and in situ archaeology shouldn't be excavating on the site. But I think also the records that we've kept, it's very good. And and anybody wanted to come back would easily be able to refer to our records and see exactly what had been dug and what stage we left the site at.
It is really difficult to know what to do with any kind of site once you have finished excavating it, but you can see at the end of an excavation all this amazing stuff that you really don't want to cover over forever. You'd like everybody to be able to see it, but it is so fragile and there are so few good options. I've seen some really interesting things recently with differential mowing and differential paving. There's been techniques with gravel and so on and so forth to try to make people realise exactly where everything was. But so many people say, why can't you consolidate it? Why can't you leave it open? And it's just so difficult. So there's never any ideal solution.
Well, I think with the Ness, it's not like Scarrow Brae, which is made from very hard, resilient beach stone. At the Ness, most of the stone is quarried stone. And as soon as you re-expose it, it starts to laminate. So if you left the site just open, it would very quickly deteriorate into just a pile of rubble. We don't want that. I couldn't live with that in my conscience, thinking that the Ness was deteriorating. So I think that future generations, who knows what technology will be available to them to possibly conserve, possibly to display it. But I think that, again, technology, even since we started digging here, has came on leaps and bounds. And one of the aspects of that is preserving the nest digitally. So creating 3D models, virtual reality to be able to visit the site as it was being dug just through your computer or headset, but also to see what the nest may have looked like 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing what technology can do, isn't it? And I'd be very interested to see what future generations can do with the archaeology that they've been gifted in its preserved state, thanks to the work that you've done. Nick, before we let you go, I just want to check. Helen, have you got anything you might want to ask Nick before we let him get back to the excavation here?
Well, I have got this question that's kind of burning in my mind, but I'm wrestling. I mean, as you know, Martin, one of my greatest interests in archaeology is what the questions we ask say about us. And I'm wrestling with whether my question is a much too kind of environmentally determinist thing. Now, environmental determinism, where you look at what the environment is around you and say, well, you must have lived like that because it doesn't have much rainfall or it can support an enormous crop yield or something. They've always been really unfashionable questions to ask, but they've come back into fashion, I think, with things like our awareness of climate change. So I'm going to have a stab at asking this huge question, which Nick may think is A, impossible to answer, or B, impossible to answer in a sensible way. But really, it's what is it about the Orkneys? Because we've heard about how tens of thousands of tons of rock have been quarried just to build the Ness of Brodgar. And there's so much else happening on the Orkneys. There's so much innovation happening there. But it must always have been difficult to generate the surplus of food that's needed to feed that huge labour force. It must always have been more difficult on the Orkneys than, say, on the Isle of Wight, for instance. But everything is happening there. I mean, from pottery to henges, it goes on and on and on. How come it's all happening in the Neolithic on the Orkneys? That's what I'd like to know. I'd like to know Nick's view. And I know you can't answer, you can't say, well, it's because of this, this and this. But what I want to hear, Nick, is your take on it, because I think that will say so many interesting things about how we view the Orkneys and the rest of the country today.
Well, I think environmental determinism, yes, is a bit old hat or has been seen that way. But I think the environment does determine a lot of what happens, not only today, but also in prehistory. I wouldn't say it's the main reason. There's so many other social factors that feed into the construction of these. But I think when it comes to Orkney, I think what attracted people to Orkney, the first Neolithic farmers, was the fertility of the land. You know, sitting here in the kitchen, you can just gaze across at the locks, and it's just very much this kind of green and pleasant land. It's controlled by the Gulf Stream, so it's never that cold, or really.
You might say that.
tropical. But I think that Orkney has always been an agricultural economy. I think it's always said that what's the difference between an Orkadian and a Shetlander? Well, a Shetlander is a fisherman with a small croft, whereas an Orkadian is a farmer with a small fishing boat. So that different emphasis on the mainstays of the economy. But it is the light, easily cultivatable land that we see in Orkney. And that is due to the underlying geology, basically old red sandstone. And I think that is a main factor about why Orkney was able to create all these monuments, to create the surplus, because it's a huge surplus that would have been required to support the people who undertook all of this work, whether it's the quarrying, the building. But also, it's not just one site, as you said. You know, just looking from the window here, I could probably point out the best part of 50 other Neolithic sites just in this vicinity. So the concentration of them, there's nowhere else quite like it, apart from maybe the Wessex area. But I think that the Neolithic population a few years ago was always seen as maybe in the low thousands in Orkney. But back in the 19th century, Orkney supported a population of about 35,000 people, all living basically in small farmsteads. But that's quite a jump from the present population of Orkney, which is about 23,000. So it just shows the fertility of the land, what it can support, the level of population. So environmental determinism, yeah, why not? At least part of the answer.
That's fascinating. Thank you very much, Nick. It's good. It's really interesting to see how thought changes over the years. And the idea that the Neolithic population could have been so high, the thought that in the 19th century there were 35,000 people living there, that's pretty remarkable from my very southern viewpoint. So thank you.
Yeah, and thank you so much for spending the time to talk to us in the kitchen. We're going to let you get back and walk the few meters now down back to the dig, back to the excavation, which is ongoing. If you, by the way, are listening and you want to ask your own question about the Nessa Brodgar, or indeed about anything to do with archaeology, you know we like to do this a lot on the Time Team podcast. Patreon is where you need to go and become a Time Team member. Time Team members, by the way, have been getting access to updates on this dig as it happens for weeks now. You can go and check them all out, watch all of the dig watches, some of which I've presented, by the way. It's been really good fun doing that. You can go and check out so much from this excavation online right now. Become a Time Team member and support the work we're doing with Time Team. patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
And that's it from the Time Team podcast this week. But we do, of course, have more from the Nessa Brodgar on Orkney next week, don't we, Martin? What are you going to be getting up to next week?
Yeah, I'm going to be getting up close and personal with the dig, really. So you'll meet the archaeologists who are here every day uncovering the archaeology, the history beneath our feet, and trying to get a little bit closer to understanding those tantalising geophysics images.
And following the release of our classic episode about Jamestown in the US on YouTube earlier this month, we'll hear from Jamestown itself and the archaeological work that's still going on there.
All that then on the next Time Team podcast. But from here in Orkney, take care and speak to you next week.
Bye-bye.